First up, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugalpul peoples, the Mananjali, Yugumbe, Kombamiri, Kwandamuka and Noonuckle peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the first peoples of the land and elders of the more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service. Welcome to you all. That little message there during the news, crossing the line, that's a great message. And crossing the line is so relevant in many, many different ways, different areas, different aspects of our lives. We've got to be mindful that we don't cross the line when we're dealing with other human beings, dealing with nature. Most walks of life, we've got to be mindful of crossing the line. I think it's a great message. We could be doing a lot more with crossing the line. Today, my guest is Dr. Reuben Bolt. Reuben's thesis is about urban Aboriginal identity. He's the first First Nations PhD graduate of the Faculty of Health Sciences at the University of Sydney. He has 10 years teaching experience across 6 universities in New South Wales and has worked on various research projects within Aboriginal communities. His research interest is Indigenous knowledge and identity. So we're talking about urban Aboriginal identity. And, you know, identity is an interesting thing. We're going to be looking at, I suppose, the construction of Aboriginal identity. We're going to look at what identity is, how it provides the foundation for both for the protection and preservation of urban-based Aboriginal identity. How identity comes from stories. So it's just fantastic. It's great that it's a privilege to have young Dr. Reuben Bolt. And I say young Dr. Reuben Bolt because I've known this bloke since he was a young fella. Reuben, welcome to Let's Talk. It's great to have you on as a guest on the program. And like I say, it is a privilege. So welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for that, Cole. Very happy to be on the program.
Tell us your mob, your country.
Well, I grew up in the Nowra area, the Shoalhaven, which is about 2 hours south of Sydney. That's the Wundandian people. That's on my maternal grandmother's side. And basically, I lived there for about, up till about the age of 6 or 7. Then I moved to Bathurst. We lived at Tower at a hostel. My parents were the house parents. Did all my high schooling there, then went back to Nowra. So I've been there since, I finished year 12 in Nowra. So what's that, about 15 years now? So that's, and then on my grandfather's side is Monero, Ngarrigay people. Dunich is my mob.
And the Dunich dancers are all your family. Your well-known uncle, who is no longer with us and is sadly missed, Bob McLeod.
Mm-hmm. In the early years when we first started the dance company, it was basically all of Nan's grandkids that were in the dance company. So, except for one fella, Cecil. He's his grandfather, my grandfather, are brothers. So he was a second cousin, but all the rest were first cousins. That's how it started earlier.
And Big Cess was out, he got roots back into Wiradjuri country, hasn't he?
Back
down Dubbo way?
Yeah, Dubbo way, yeah.
All right. Now, when did you decide to go to university and what were the reasons?
Yeah, I think for me, I did a bit of dancing as soon as I left school. So I danced for about 3 or 4 years and I went overseas. I went to Scotland and went to New Zealand with you and your mob. Was over there.
That was a great trip.
Yeah, we did 36 shows in 30 days.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. Down that Wanganui River in the canoes.
Yeah, 3 days it took us, I remember.
So
I did that. I went to Namibia. So I went to 3 countries, but the boys, they've been to about 25, 30 countries now. They're always travelling around, so it's really good to see that. And then in about 1998, I started uni. And because I was dancing, and you know, with the dancing, it's good in terms of, you know, keeping culture alive and doing those kind of things. But at the same time, it's not really an income. You know, you get a bit of money here and there, but you can't really rely on that. So I thought I'll go to uni, and my dad said to me, "Why don't you go and try uni?" And I said, "Nah, I won't be able to do it." And he said, "Well, if you go to uni, you won't have to put in a DOL form. You can get on AB study," and that's the only reason I went to uni. And, well, I was 21, 22 then. That's the only reason I tried it out.
Look where it's got you.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, it's, 10, 11 years later, I've got 3 degrees now. So, it was an opportunity. It was opportunistic. And I thought I'd have a go at it. So and that's how it happened.
Yes. Well, I'm sorry. What was the course? What did you study at university and why?
The reason I studied there is because all my mob was there. So had, you know, Uncle Paul and Auntie Vida and about 4 or 5 cousins that were there. And because they were there, it was a block mode course. And so it meant we can go in for 3 blocks per semester. And they said, you know, let's go and try that. So I went and had a go, and it was a Bachelor of Health Science, Aboriginal Health and Community Development. So basically it was a health worker course.
All right.
I went in there and, you know, but the difference with that in school, at school I didn't even really try. I didn't really read one English book when I was in high school because I didn't really want to be there. But when I was at uni, it was different. And, you know, I tried it. You know, I had a good go at it. And this is what I tell my students now: if you're gonna have a go at uni, well, have a good go. You know, if you're gonna mow the lawn, don't leave any gaps. You know, have a bit of pride in trying to do something. Because if you try as your best you can do and you don't get through, then at least you can say you tried.
You gave it your best shot.
Yeah, you gave it your best shot. So
that's interesting. Yeah. You never read an English book. You never really tried. You didn't want to be at school. Why was that? Why didn't you want to be at school?
I don't know, that's weird because my nan now, she has, well, my son Tariq, he was born last year. He turned 1 the other day. He was the 103rd great-grandchild.
103? Auntie Belle got 103 great-grandchildren?
Yeah, well, there's more now because there's been more that are born after him.
Wow.
And she's got about 50 or 60 grandchildren. Now, I'm in about the middle of the grandkids.
Oh,
and at that time when I was going to high school, I had about 5 or 6 cousins that were male that were older, and they didn't go through. They pulled out of high school. So my goal at that time was I'm going to finish my HSC. And so I had a goal to do that, and that was the only goal I had in life at that time, you know. And because, you know, for me, university wasn't realistic. You know, we didn't have any role model at that time.
So you didn't aspire or think about going to university while you were in high school?
Well, I didn't think it was achievable. None of the black fellas at school, you know, were thinking about university. No one in my community was thinking about university. Not that I knew of. So, yeah, to me it was unachievable. I didn't even think about that. So I had the goal to get my HSC, and that's what I put put my mind to it, and I did that.
All right. Do you think things have changed looking back, looking around you? You're bringing up your own kids. Looking around all that experience in teaching in all those universities and your experience now, reflecting on things, have things changed all that much in this regard, in this perspective of education and thinking about going to university and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think it has. I think a lot's changed. I haven't really thought about it that much, but I know that because I work at Nirigilli at the University of New South Wales, and we've got a winter program, and that's a program where we have year 10, 11 and 12 students come in and they can just get a taste of university culture. And so, you know, we've got 100, 200 kids, and the actual university now is getting a name people are calling, you know, like young kids in the community are saying, oh, you know that Winter School University? And I thought, that's deadly that the kids are associating the Winter School with a particular university. And I think it means we're doing some good things. So in that sense, you know, I know that there are programs in place for young kids to actually go and, you know, get a little bit of a taste of university culture. So that definitely wasn't happening when I was younger. So a lot's changed.
All right. Well, that's great. So your thesis now, you went through uni, you obviously got your degree in health sciences, was it?
Yep.
What made you want to continue on?
Well, when I went through the first degree, a Bachelor of Health Science, the first 2 years I got pretty good grades because I had a go at it, and I actually got considered for honours. And then I thought, oh, I don't know if I can do that. And I thought, no, I'll have a go at it. So I had a go at it, and I ended up getting a second class Division One, which was just under a first class honours. So I did that, and in that thesis, the topic was institutional racism in the judicial system. And so I just did a qualitative study, and I interviewed, it was only six people from the Nowra area, and just asked them about their experiences. And it wasn't people who had been incarcerated, it was also family members. So I sort of looked at the impact on family as well. And so based on that, I said, I'm not going to go and do another thesis because, you know, it was a lot of work. It was 20,000 words, and for me that was a lot back then. So I went and did a master's degree, and it was a master's by coursework. And it was supposed to be done in 18 months, but I did all audio production, and I didn't have the prerequisites to do a documentary because I wanted to do a documentary on my grandmother's life. And so they said, well, if you want to do that, I had to go back and do another 6 months to get the prerequisites. I said, no, that's okay. I'm happy to do that. So I went back, did the documentary production and film production courses. And then I ended up doing the documentary on my nan's life, and it ended up at 33 minutes. And the way I look at that is, I didn't have the funds to pay for it. I suppose I still pay for it through student fees, and I'm paying that off now in my tax, you know. I was able to use high quality equipment, proper film editing facilities. And so I did get a master's degree out of it, but I also got to document my grandmother's life. So that's something that I'm very passionate about. And then after that, I ended up thought to myself, well, I've done this now. What am I going to do? And I didn't really have a job. I was working part-time and casually at the universities doing a bit of teaching. I thought, no, well, I'll go in and I'll have a go at a PhD. And so I enrolled, and then I got through. So,
and that's where this thesis is coming from, which had a working title of Urban Aboriginal Identity.
Yeah, and basically that what I addressed in the thesis was, this idea of Aboriginality and how we use Aboriginality to claim identities and to actually claim, which informs our sense of self, because I think the most important thing is sense of self, because identity, there are many identities that we can draw from, and so we actually draw on various identities, and as long as that resonates with our sense of self, that's how we're able to tell people about who we are.
Why did you select identity? Because of, there's obviously a connection, and I know there is a connection between identity, sense of self, and well-being, health and well-being.
Mm.
But you tell us, why identity? Why was it important for you?
Well, that was back, if I track back to my teen years, I have these identity questioning episodes. And so it was at the point where I got to, probably 13 or 14 or 15, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm dealing with all the stuff that happens at school. If there's, racism and this whole idea about, dirty blacks and, Aboriginal people are no good and they're lazy and whatever. So there are all those kind of constructions that were imposed on Aboriginal people. And as an Aboriginal person, you have to deal with that. And so it got to the point where I thought, well, am I really an Aboriginal person? I speak English. I eat McDonald's. I drive a car. I wear clothes. I probably do most things Western than Aboriginal. And so at that time, I didn't understand, but I was trying to deal with all these identities that were imposed on our people. And so for me, it was a it sort of impacted on me, and so I got really interested in this idea of identity, and particularly Aboriginal identity. And so that's where it came from. So at that time, I thought I knew everything, probably like most teenagers. And I had this, there were two premises that I had. One was nothing can exist without my memory. And the other one, the world is only a creation in my memory. And so basically what I'm saying is without my memory, nothing can exist. And so that was something that I went through back then. And so that was sort of more the radical constructionist that was coming out of me. But now when I look back at that, you know, obviously there are collective identities as well. And so, but we only get our identity from socialization. And so it depends on where you're socialized, because you're socialized in various environments, and those environments can be political, they can be cultural, you know what I mean, particular at a particular historical moment. And so, you know, I was born in the mid-70s, so obviously there's a lot of politics and culture that's happening at the local level in the various communities. And so I suppose at that point, you know, I was still trying to deal with that, trying to understand who I was.
You had the great fortune of socialising in both worlds. You're two ways strong. You learnt song, dance and culture. And now you're Dr. Reuben Bolt. I was going to say McLeod, your mum's family.
Yeah,
Dr. Reuben. So two ways strong. I mean, that's a strong position to be in, to be two ways strong with this, with cultural identity intact.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because one of the things I sort of had to deal with in the thesis was, because what happens is when you write a thesis, you write for a particular audience, and that particular audience is three examiners. That's the audience, because I need to write for them to show them that I'm competent with a certain method. And so the method that I used in my thesis, you know, I knew that I had to research and find the appropriate theoretical framework, find the appropriate analytical framework, and present that. And so I had to write it in such a way that, you know, it had to be academic and had to be in accordance with the conventions of the university. But at the same time, you know, what I was saying in the thesis, when I looked at the theoretical perspective, I was saying that identity only comes from stories, and you can only gain a sense of identity or sense of self through the stories that you're socialised in. But when I spoke to some of the participants didn't say that. They said, no, identity comes from the land. So I had to try to reconcile that. What does that mean? How can this thesis be saying your identity can only come from stories when the participants are saying, no, it comes from the land? So then the way I reconciled it was to say that in terms of the stories are ontological, which means that you only exist because of the stories. And so really, as long as you understand, you know, where those, or not really where they come from, but what they actually mean, that's where identity comes from. It comes from stories.
Now, you mentioned to me before we went to air the same thing. Identity comes from stories. Similarly, Christianity.
Yeah, I think with any human identity construction, all human identity is based on stories. We think in narratives, regardless of where, you know, whichever culture it is, there obviously are different elements of culture, so it might be different language, there might be different nuances, there might be different beliefs, different practices, different kinds of obligations, which are based on those cultures. But at the end of the day, in terms of human identity, the most fundamental thing is that it comes from stories. And so if you think about I use the example of Christianity. So we know that, you know, there might be a science, a different kind of science that says that doesn't necessarily agree with, you know, various elements of the Christian religion. But at the end of the day, it's not about what's true. It's not about what's fact. It's about what's true. So if you believe in something, that's your belief system. And so your identity comes from those stories. And it's with any identity, so, or any, you know, I can, at the same time, I can say my identity comes from my Aboriginality, and I have a belief in that. Well, that's the only thing that's important. It's about the belief system.
All right. Now that you've satisfied those three examiners with your writing, with your thesis, would you change it any? Does it need to be changed in any way at all? Because you don't have to satisfy three examiners. You only have to satisfy you, maybe your grandma or your family or your mob. Mm. How do you feel about it? What do you think?
Well, now that I'm at UNSW, our director is Professor Martin Nakatar, and he's trying to, obviously, you know, we're looking at my track record for the next 5 years, and probably one thing that should come out of it, or he's pushing for, is to write a book based on the thesis. And obviously the book is going to be should be different to the thesis, because it's not targeting an academic audience. So there'll be different chapters that will come out, like, you know, how, like the methodology chapter, for example, should come out of that. And then maybe talk about some of the issues that are more, that, you know, the wider community would be interested in, if it's this politics of identity. At the moment, there's a feralism, you know what I mean? There's a lot of different academics, things that are happening in this country, and I don't see there's a sense of cohesion in Australia. So, you know, maybe probably teasing out some of those other ideas about, you know, even this idea of Aboriginality, what it actually means for certain different communities.
Mm. That'd be great to see. You think you might well do it, pursue it?
Yeah, well, you know, at the moment I'm just winding up for teaching for this semester, so I've got to have some marks in by next week. So I've got a few more assessments to mark. We figured out our teaching plan for next year, so obviously I'll be doing some teaching. But it's really about trying to set a research program. And with that research program, try to inform, you know, obviously the next publications that come along with that. And I'm seriously considering writing a book based on this idea of urban Aboriginal identity.
Great. Can't wait for that one. So, Reuben, when we get questioned a lot, we get denied our identity a lot, we as First Nations people, because when questioned, we'll say, well, yeah, we're Aboriginal, but then the response will be, but oh, you don't look Aboriginal, you know. Well, I've got mixed heritage, of course, there's Irish and there's this and there's that. And then the obvious question is, well, why do you identify as Aboriginal? You don't have to, you know, you have a choice. So this choice, this self-identification process, brings in the racism and discrimination and stuff like that, but it also brings some satisfaction. Tell us a little about your experience in talking to people and self-identification and some of the negatives and the positives.
I think with my PhD, if I just talk about the data, because I only interviewed 11 people, and that was enough for a PhD, but basically the question I asked them was, tell me about your identity. That's the first question I asked all the participants. Tell me about your identity. And basically there were three different generations. And so I wanted to look at the differences between the generations. So we're talking 20 to 40, 41 to 60 and 61 plus. So basically what happened is, when I said, tell me about your identity, they all told stories about their lives. And so when I looked at the stories, especially the older generations, those were stories about, you know, living on the mission, or stories about, you know, racism or whatever. So there were various stories that they told, and a lot of it was during their childhood. And so what that tells me is that they're actually socialised at a particular historical moment. And that historical moment, you know, there are various, like I said earlier, political, cultural, social environments that give you various resources, I suppose, and you draw from those resources when you engage in conversation with people. And so basically when they had drawn on those, told those different stories, it was really stories of marginalisation. And I know a lot of people would say, well, stories of disadvantage, but it wasn't disadvantage, it was marginalisation. Aboriginal people were marginalised. The result now is disadvantage, but it's still based on that history. It's based on that colonial history, and it's a history that's evolved over the past 200 and whatever, 20 years. So in that sense, you know, we're still trying to deal with that. And the history of place, I think, is very important because that's where the stories come from. The only reason we know about Captain Cook is because the story's been continually told. And if the story's written down or not, it doesn't matter. It doesn't. There might have been things that happened before Captain Cook, but if it's not documented, it doesn't become part of history. And I think that's one of the things I learned about too is during that thesis is that, you know, history always changes and it depends on who tells the story. You know, I think the narrative about Captain Cook is firmly embedded in the way in Australian society, so that probably won't change. But I don't know, 500 years' time, it mightn't be so significant. I don't know. Depends what happens, I suppose, in terms of the politics of the country. But at this point in time, you know, Australia is trying to project itself as having a proud colonial history. And in the last couple of years, you know, 20 or 30, 40 years, I think there's been a push towards acknowledging Indigenous peoples as first peoples of this nation. And so, yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's really about there are various historical resources that we draw from. Again, you know, the history is one of those prominent ones. So that's sort of the broader macro. And then you've got the personal experiences that occur within the local community or at the local level. So people in the Nowra area, some lived at Wreck Bay, some lived at various other places, little camps around the town. They told stories about those camps and this idea of not being allowed into pubs and clubs and cinemas and that kind of stuff. So it's really it's about how that had impacted on the participants. And probably the prominent finding from my PhD was that Aboriginal identity is a problem. And that was something that was a bit difficult for me to deal with because as an Aboriginal person from my community, I would never have thought Aboriginal identity is a problem. And the reason for that is because all I've really heard, I've heard about the, you know, the negatives, the stories of racism, whatever, but I don't know, it's like Aboriginal people have this, this sense of resilience. And so the thing I was really more interested in was pride in Aboriginal identity. But at the same time, when I looked at the stories, they were talking about the negative aspect. And so the negative aspect was really about the Western influence. And so what they tried to do was to reconcile the positive and the negative, and that caused the problem. That's where the problem comes from.
That's interesting. Mm. Trying to reconcile the positive and the negatives of identity and your own experience with self-identification.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you say to that? Well, how do you deal with that? How would one... What's the best way for dealing with that in trying to reconcile? Do you bother reconciling? I mean, you've got to deal with these issues. Mm. It's the other side, the flip side of the coin.
I think you always reconcile, just even if you do it subconsciously. You always have to reconcile it because if you have a strength in Aboriginal identity and people saying you're a half-caste, well, half-caste means that you're not authentic, but you say, no, I'm a black fellow, I am authentic. You know, regardless, like we said earlier, regardless of, you know, descent, and I know I've got, there's Scottish descent, I know there's Irish descent, but I haven't been socialised as an Irishman or a Scotsman. I've been socialised as an Aboriginal person based on the culture of the Shoalhaven. And that Shoalhaven culture is, you know, is shaped by the regional and it's shaped by the national. So there are various policies and legislation that's put in place that actually impacts the locals, the various local cultures around this country. And all of that is shaped by the international movements, you know, this idea of human rights. We know that happened in the Human Rights Declaration happened in 1948. And it's only after that time that these things started to impact on various countries and also the local cultures within those countries. So, you know, 67 was the referendum. That still was quite a bit of time after the human rights. But obviously there's a lot of other things that happened in between that. And so I think, probably one of the main reasons why things have moved forward is because of the international moral that's been set by the United Nations.
That's great how you explain that. It's how you've been socialised.
Mm.
Because that white fella puts on us, or not always white fella, but people question our identity And they said, well, why do you choose to be Aboriginal? You know, why do you choose to identify? You look like me, you look white or something. Mm. And I've often said to that person that's questioning me, well, what do you identify as? And they also have mixed heritage. Mm. Could be South African, could be Scottish, Irish, whatever. Mm. But they claim to be Australian because they've been socialised as Australian,
mm.
as we have been socialised as First Nations men or First Nations people. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think, see, the way I look at it too is rather than say heritage, I wouldn't say I have mixed heritage, but what I would say I have mixed descent because I haven't been socialised in those cultures.
Mm.
But on the same side, this is the paradox. I speak English. See, but it's more about the mentality. Even though I speak English, I identify as Aboriginal. And the point is, because culture always changes, culture, it's never static, culture always changes, therefore Aboriginality, well, I'll speak for my own community and probably many various other Aboriginal communities in this country, but Aboriginality in the Shoalhaven means, you know, like, let's just say, for example, I'll just give this as an example. I know that there's been various people in the community that have never been Aboriginal, and the next minute, you know, not all their life they've never identified, and then next minute they've found some heritage, Aboriginal heritage or descent, and then they claim an Aboriginal identity. And, you know, one of my aunties was talking in a meeting there a couple of years back. She was saying, I'm sick of these Babs. I was like, what's Babs? These born-again blacks. You know, they've never been Aboriginal, and then when the job comes up, they become Aboriginal and they start to claim the identity. So at the same time, really, it's more about the personal claim. Anyone can claim any identity, but if it doesn't have community recognition, that's where the issue comes from, you know?
Oh, yes. And that leads into my next question then. What about the government, the government compliance for Aboriginal, or the government term or the acceptance?
Yeah, the definition.
The definition, that's the word I'm looking for. You got it. What about that one?
Yeah, the three-pronged definition. So,
that one.
You know, you claim Aboriginality, you claim to be from a community, or you claim descent. So, yeah, well, I suppose that is a claim of descent.
Yeah, or claiming that bloodline or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And then there's you claim to belong to a community and you have community recognition. Now, that's another identity, or even that's the criteria for Aboriginality that's imposed on Aboriginal people. So if we think about, like, an Aboriginal person that's a stolen generation and taken away at birth. Now, if they were taken to China, for example, culturally they'll be Chinese because they'll learn Chinese culture, right?
Mm.
But they might still claim an Aboriginal identity by virtue of descent. But if they come back into the community and they can't speak English, then they're not Aboriginal. You see what I mean? Because the culture changes. So the Aboriginal culture here, we still know bits and pieces of Aboriginal language in our local area. And we use that in our song and dance too, you know, when the boys dance and stuff.
Yes.
But we don't speak that fluently. But that doesn't mean we're less Aboriginal, because our Aboriginality is based on our local culture, which is said in English.
Mm.
Mm.
So you're saying, when you just said, so they're not Aboriginal because they don't speak English, they speak in Chinese, they're not Aboriginal under the government definition.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then you have the other issue of, someone who's been socialised in an Aboriginal community all their life, and then if they find out that, you know, just say they were taken away or whatever, but then if they do some historical research, and there's been a couple of famous cases about that, do some historical research and find out that their father wasn't even Aboriginal, but they've been socialised all their life as an Aboriginal person. So culturally, yes, they are Aboriginal, but they still don't meet the government's definition. And that's the problem with the government's definition. For me, I think it's more about self-identification. But then there are other ramifications about community acceptance and all that kind of stuff. So Aboriginal identity is very political. Any identity is political, but I think Aboriginal identity especially is political.
This is an interesting point that you raise, because often in my experience, I have found members of the dominant society, white fellow, white Australians, socialised in a black community most of their lives. They're still a white fella under that government definition and stuff, but to black community, no, that's one of the mob. His family, this fella, he's been adopted by this family.
Mm.
So they're taken in and recognised in the community as one of us.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
create some issues for some people, because, again, we're being caught up in this language and in these government definitions and stuff like that. It certainly creates some problems, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, I think. And that, again, that's, I think that's the nature of identity.
Mm.
Identity will always be political.
Was there any experiences... Well, hang on. Let's go back to Stolen Gens. A couple of the case studies that you did were stolen generational survivors, people. How was their experience? Anything you can talk about there?
I think this really exemplifies the power of the story. You know, because your identity can only come from stories. And what had actually happened is I spoke with one lady and I asked her about her identity, and immediately she spoke about being taken away as a child. And, you know, and she was saying she ended up in Sydney, and when she was talking to some of the local people, the Aboriginal people from Sydney, they're saying, "You Aboriginal?" She's saying, "No, I'm a half-caste." And I said, "No, you can't be a half-caste. You're Aboriginal or you're not." And see, I think that's a result of the local culture and how that formed at that time. But she was like, "Well, no, I'm a half-caste." And she didn't know she was Aboriginal until she mixed with other Aboriginal people in Sydney. And that's because where she was taken away, they were continually told, "You're not Aboriginal, you're not like them people, you're different."
Mm.
And again, so your identity comes from the stories. And so when I looked at that and I said to that particular person, was it a problem, you know, that you're taking away? She goes, "Oh, I don't really think about it much and it doesn't really impact on me that much." But everything that she said had been related to being taken away. So it was obviously a very important part of her identity. And then when I spoke to her daughter, it just happened that I ended up speaking to her daughter. And her daughter, I said to her the same thing, "Tell me about your identity." And she told me about all these, all different stories. And the one story that she kept returning to, and this is what I call the prime narrative, so it was something that they kept returning to. So they'll talk about one thing and then go and talk about something else, but they return back to that prime narrative. And that happened over and over. And her prime narrative was not knowing her mother's mob. And that's the intergenerational impact. So, you know, and this was someone who was, I think, very well articulate, someone who, you know, had, you know, real good sense about her. But at the end of the day, she kept returning back to this idea of not knowing her mother's mob. And so, you know, clearly I think that shows the intergenerational trauma that's happened there.
Yes, a serious issue too. Okay, we've been talking about identity largely for our mob, First Nations people. Identity for a white brother, white Australians. Come here. They've got a real identity problem going on, the majority. Now, identity must be important to all individuals, all human beings. What are your thoughts here? And in that context of white Australians and identity?
Yeah, see, I don't know. It's I haven't done any research in that area, but I'm just trying to think of just a couple of examples where I know that some people that I know that have come to Australia and English is their second language, and basically what they say is, or probably two or three of them have said this, that that they're trying to think in English. And when I think about that, you know, I'm thinking, what does that mean? If they're trying to think in English, because obviously when you speak English and the other language is your first language, you'll be thinking in the other language to try to make sense, you know, in the English language. So
they're code switching.
Yeah. And so what they do is then after that, when they've been socialised in Australian culture for enough time, they actually begin to think in English. And when they do that, there are other cultural nuances that they internalise as well. So they actually start to use English words and whatever. I think a really good example of that, in terms of Australian culture, is my wife, who's actually from the Bahamas. And it's English, it's broken English that they speak in the Bahamas. But, so when she's come here, she's learning all these different cultural nuances, so especially like Koori nuances from the Shoalhaven area. So she knows all these different words now. She's been here for 6.5 years, 7 years almost. And so, you know, she became an Australian citizen. So legally, she's Australian. Now, I've got two kids. Their mothers are Bahamian, and I'm their father. So are they Aboriginal or are they Bahamian? Well, I'm saying it's okay for them to be both. I would never deny them their mother's heritage because that's a part of who they are. And so I think this is what we're sort of dealing with at this point in time too, is, you know, we've got people like Aboriginal people that are, you know, having children or marrying people from other cultures. And I think what we should really try and do is to try and draw on the strength in that. You know, people fall in love, you know. Doesn't matter.
That's,
you know,
right,
culture,
eh?
Or whatever. That's what happens. So, and really it's more about trying to, for me, really it's more about making sure that my kids have a good sense of self.
Yeah.
And I would prefer them to be drawing on Aboriginality, the positive aspects of Aboriginality, than trying to deny that.
Most certainly.
But I suppose at the end of the day, when they get older, it's going to be their choice anyway.
Tell us about this, what I just referred to as regarded as code switching. You're talking about people from overseas, English as a second language. We could be talking about our own mob out in the territory, in the central desert, up in Cape York, in different places of this country where our mob, English is second or third language.
Mm.
I would think they are trying, especially school kids and people that are studying, are trying to think in English a lot of the times and getting very confused, just in order to make sense of the class or the lesson or what's being taught. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. It makes a lot of sense. I might have to have a bit more of a think about that one. Because, again, I haven't really had a lot of contact with many of the remote communities. I've been to different places and stuff, but, you know, I think to really understand it, you've got to really be immersed in it.
Yeah, socialise it, you know, that way.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. You've got to be socialised in it. Yeah.
Man, this is a fantastic yarn. I really enjoy it and see there's a lot of merit, a lot of benefit, a lot of value just in this discussion, and it's just fantastic. We're running out of time. Is there anything you want to say? The importance of identity for people, it doesn't have to be black people, because I think identity is important for a white fellow, for any human being. I think identity is important. Is there anything you want to say in regards to this?
Yeah, I think I'll just quickly draw on some of the theoretical perspective that I've been trying to do a bit of research in lately. And there's a guy by the name of McAdams. He talks about how you would develop an identity or develop a sense of self, but through various identities over the life course. And what happens is when you get into your early or late teens, early emerging adult years, you actually start to think about what is going to be my legacy, you know, what can I leave behind for my kids? And so there's this, what he calls this generativity discourse. And so when we develop a generativity discourse, it's more about looking at what's going to be the future for Aboriginal identity. And I think that that's really important. And if we can think about that and think about what's the best contribution that I can make, what's the best contribution that I can make, not only to Aboriginal people, but I suppose to the country in general, you know, we can all make an impact in various ways. And so, I think if we can start to think about that and look at more towards the future, and then that way we can hopefully, you know, sort of develop a culture where there's more of a reciprocal respect between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. I think that's the way I would like to see it go. But again, this country is still built on a penal mentality, a colonial mentality, and it's that negative history, I think, that continually gets retold. And so it's hard to sort of look towards the future if you've got the baggage from the past that's all negative. So I think, yeah, trying to figure out a way to sort of navigate our way through that process.
Mate, well said. And that penal mentality, that colonial mentality permeates society in a sickening way, and it's just sad. Look, thanks for joining us. It's great to have a chat with you, and we'll talk some more.
Yeah, thanks, Uncle.
And I'm going to go up with a song from your uncle, Bob McLeod, and it's called The Dance.
Okay.
And regards to all the old mob.
Yep.
You have a good day. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
That's Dr. Reuben Bolt talking to us there about identity.